Part 2. Susan. Chapter 1. Beneath the Kissing Moon. 1. A perfect disk of silver, the Kissing Moon, as it was called, in full earth, hung above the ragged hill 5 miles east of Hambry and 10 miles south of Eyebolt Canyon. Below the hill, the late summer heat still held, suffocating even 2 hours after sundown, but atop the coos, it was as if REAP had already come, with its strong breezes and frost-pinched air. For the woman who lived here, with no company but a snake and one old mutey cat, it was to be a long night. "Never mind, though. Never mind, my dear. Busy hands are happy hands, so they are." She waited until the hoofbeats of her visitors' horses had faded, sitting quietly by the window in the hut's large room. There was only one other, a bedroom, little bigger than a closet. Musty, the six-legged cat, was on her shoulder. Her lap was full of moonlight. 3 horses bearing away 3 men. The big coffin hunters, they called themselves. She snorted. Men were funny. Aye, so they were. And the most amusing thing about them was how little they knew it. Men, with their swaggering, belt-hitching names for themselves. Men so proud of their muscles, their drinking capacities, their eating capacities, so everlastingly proud of their pricks. Yes, even in these times, when a good many of them could shoot nothing but strange, bent seed that produced children fit only to be drowned in the nearest well. Ah, but it was never their fault, was it, dear? No, always it was the woman, her womb, her fault. Men were such cowards, such grinning cowards. These 3 had been no different from the general run. The old one with the limp might bear watching, aye, so he might. A clear and overly curious pair of eyes had looked out at her from his head. But she saw nothing in them she could not deal with, came it to that. Men. She could not understand why so many women feared them. Hadn't the gods made them with the most vulnerable part of their guts hanging right out of their bodies like a misplaced bit of bowel? Kicked them there and they curled up like snails, caressed them there and their brains melted. Anyone who doubted that second bit of wisdom need only look at her night's second bit of business, the one which still lay ahead. Thorin, mayor of Hambry, chief guard of Barony, no fool like an old fool. Yet none of these thoughts had any real power over her, or any real malice to them, at least not now. The 3 men who called themselves the Big Coffin Hunters had brought her a marvel, and she would look at it, aye, fill up her eyes with it, so she would. The gimp, Jonas, had insisted she put it away. He had been told she had a place for such things, not that he wanted to see it himself, not any of her secret places, gods forbid. At this sally, DePape and Reynolds had laughed like trolls. And so she had. But the hoofbeats of their horses had been swallowed by the wind now, and she would do as she liked. The girl whose tits had stolen what little there was of Hart Thorin's mind would not be here for another hour at least. The old woman had insisted that the girl walk from town, citing the purification value of such a moonlit heel and toe, actually just wanting to put a safe bumper of time between her 2 appointments, and during that hour she would do as she liked.
"Oh, it's beautiful, I'm sure it is," she whispered.
And did she feel a certain heat in that place where her ancient bow legs came together? A certain moisture in the dry creek which hid there? Gods!
Aye, even through the box where they hid it, I felt its glam. So beautiful, Musty, like you.
She took the cat from her shoulder and held it in front of her eyes. The old Tom purred and stretched out its pug of a face toward hers. She kissed its nose. The cat closed its milky gray-green eyes in ecstasy.
So beautiful, like you. So you are, he.
She put the cat down. It walked slowly toward the hearth, where a late fire lazed, desultorily eating at a single log. Musty's tail, split at the tip so it looked like the forked tail of a devil in an old drawing, switched back and forth in the room's dim orange air. Its extra legs, dangling from its sides, twitched dreamily. The shadow which trailed across the floor and grew up the wall was a horror, a thing that looked like a cat crossed with a spider. The old woman rose and went into her sleeping closet, where she had taken the thing Jonas had given her.
"Lose that, and you'll lose your head," he'd said. "Never fear me, my good friend," she'd replied, directing a cringing, servile smile back over her shoulder, all the while thinking men, foolish, strutting creatures they were.
Now she went to the foot of her bed, knelt, and passed one hand over the earth floor there. Lines appeared in the soured dirt as she did. They formed a square. She pushed her fingers into one of these lines. It gave before her touch. She lifted the hidden panel, hidden in such a way that no one without the touch would ever be able to uncover it, revealing a compartment perhaps a foot square and 2 feet deep. Within it was an ironwood box. Curled atop the box was a slim green snake. When she touched its back, its head came up. Its mouth yawned in a silent hiss, displaying 4 pairs of fangs, 2 on top, 2 on the bottom. She took the snake up, crooning to it. As she brought its flat face close to her own, its mouth yawned wider and its hissing became audible. She opened her own mouth. From between her wrinkled gray lips, she poked the yellowish, bad-smelling mat of her tongue. 2 drops of poison, enough to kill an entire dinner party if mixed in the punch, fell on it. She swallowed, feeling her mouth and throat and chest burn, as if with strong liquor. For a moment the room swam out of focus, and she could hear voices murmuring in the stenchy air of the hut, the voices of those she called the Unseen Friends. Her eyes ran sticky water down the trenches time had drawn in her cheeks. Then she blew out a breath, and the room steadied. The voices faded. She kissed Ermut between his lidless eyes. "Time of the kissin' moon, all right," she thought, and then set him aside. The snake slipped beneath her bed, curled itself in a circle, and watched as she passed her palms over the top of the ironwood box. She could feel the muscles in her upper arms quivering, and that heat in her loins was more pronounced. Years it had been since she had felt the call of her sex, but she felt it now, so she did, and it was not the doing of the kissing moon, or not much. The box was locked, and Jonas had given her no key, but that was nothing to her, who had lived long and studied much and trafficked with creatures that most men, for all their bold talk and strutting ways, would run from as if on fire had they caught even the smallest glimpse of them. She stretched one hand toward the lock, on which was inlaid the shape of an eye, and a motto in the high speech, "I see who opens me," and then withdrew it. All at once she could smell what her nose no longer noticed under ordinary circumstances, must and dust and a dirty mattress and the crumbs of food that had been consumed in bed, the mingled stench of ashes and ancient incense, the odor of an old woman with wet eyes and, ordinarily at least, a dry pussy. She would not open this box and look at the wonder it contained in here. She would go outside, where the air was clean and the only smells were sage and mesquite. She would look by the light of the kissing moon. Rhea of Coos Hill pulled the box from its hole with a grunt, rose to her feet with another grunt, this one from her nether regions, tucked the box under her arm, and left the room. 2. The hut was far enough below the brow of the hill to block off the bitterest gusts of the winter wind, which blew almost constantly in these highlands from reaping until the end of wide earth. A path led to the hill's highest vantage. Beneath the full moon it was a ditch of silver. The old woman toiled up it, puffing, her white hair standing out around her head in dirty clumps, her old dug swaying from side to side under her black dress. The cat followed in her shadow, still giving off its rusty purr like a stink. At the top of the hill, The wind lifted her hair away from her ravaged face and brought her the moaning whisper of the thinny, which had eaten its way into the far end of Eyebolt Canyon. It was a sound few cared for, she knew, but she herself loved it. To Rhea of the Coos, it sounded like a lullaby. Overhead rode the moon, the shadows on its bright skin sketching the faces of lovers kissing, if you believe the ordinary fools below, that was. The ordinary fools below saw a different face or set of faces in each full moon, but the hag knew there was only one, the face of the demon, the face of death. She herself, however, had never felt more alive.
"Oh, my beauty," she whispered, and touched the lock with her gnarled fingers.
A faint glimmer of red light showed between her bunched knuckles, and there was a click. Breathing hard, like a woman who has run a race, she put the box down and opened it. Rose-colored light, dimmer than that thrown by the kissing moon, but infinitely more beautiful, spilled out. It touched the ruined face hanging above the box and for a moment made it the face of a young girl again. Musty sniffed, head stretched forward, ears laid back, old eyes rimmed with that rose light. Rhea was instantly jealous.
"Get away, foolish! 'Tis not for the likes of you."
She swatted the cat. Musty shied back, hissing like a kettle, and stalked in dudgeon to the hummock which marked the very tip of Coos Hill. There he sat, affecting disdain, and licking one paw as the wind combed ceaselessly through his fur. Within the box was a glass globe. It was filled with that rosy light. It flowed in gentle pulses, like the beat of a satisfied heart.
"Oh, my lovely one," she murmured, lifting it out.
She held it up before her, let its pulsing radiance run down her wrinkled face like rain.
"Oh, you live, so you do."
Suddenly the color within the globe darkened towards scarlet. She felt it thrum in her hands like an immensely powerful motor, and again she felt that amazing wetness between her legs, that tidal tug she believed had been left behind long ago. Then the thrumming died, and the light in the globe seemed to furl up like petals. Where it had been, there was now a pinkish gloom, and three riders coming out of it. At first she thought it was the men who had brought her the globe, Jonas and the others. But no, these were younger, even younger than DePape, who was about 25. The one on the left of the trio appeared to have a bird's skull mounted on the pommel of his saddle. Strange, but true. Then that one and the one on the right were gone, darkened away somehow by the power of the glass, leaving only the one in the middle. She took in the jeans and boots he wore, the flat-brimmed hat that hid the upper half of his face, the easy way he sat his horse. And her first alarmed thought was, "Gunslinger. Come east from the inner baronies, aye, perhaps from Gilead itself." But she did not have to see the upper half of the rider's face to know he was little more than a child, and there were no guns on his hips. Yet she didn't think the youth came unarmed. If only she could see a little better. She brought the glass almost to the tip of her nose and whispered, "Closer, lovey, closer still." She didn't know what to expect. Nothing at all seemed most likely. But within the dark circle of the glass, the figure did come closer. Swam closer, almost, like a horse and rider under water, and she saw there was a quiver of arrows on his back. Before him, on the pommel of his saddle, was not a skull but a short bow. And to the right side of the saddle, where a gunslinger might have carried a rifle in a scabbard, there was the feather-fluffed shaft of a lance. He was not one of the old people, his face had none of that look, yet she did not think he was of the outer arc, either.
"But who are ye, Cully?" she breathed, "and how shall I know ye? You've got your hat pulled down so far I can't see your god-pounding eyes, so you do. By your horse, mayhap, or perhaps by your—" "Get away, Musty, why do you trouble me so?"
The cat had come back from its lookout point and was twining back and forth between her swollen old ankles, wowing up at her in a voice even more rusty than its purr. When the old woman kicked out at him, Musty dodged agilely away, then immediately came back and started in again, looking up at her with moonstruck eyes and making those soft yowls. Rhea kicked out at it again, this one just as ineffectual as the first one, then looked into the glass once more. The horse and its interesting young rider were gone. The rose light was gone as well. It was now just a dead glass ball she held, its only light a reflection borrowed from the moon. The wind gusted, pressing her dress against the ruination that was her body. Musty, undaunted by the feeble kicks of his mistress, darted forward and began to twine about her ankles again, crying up at her the whole time.
"There, do you see what you've done, you nasty bag of fleas and disease? The light's gone out of it, gone out just when I—"
Then she heard a sound from the cart track which led up to her hut, and understood why Musty had been acting out. It was singing she heard. It was the girl she heard. The girl was early. Grimacing horribly, she loathed being caught by surprise, and the little miss down there would pay for doing it. She bent and put the glass back in its box. The inside was lined with padded silk, and the ball fit as neatly as the breakfast egg in his lordship's cup. And still from down the hill, the cursed wind was wrong, or she would have heard it sooner, the sound of the girl singing, now closer than ever.
"Love, oh love, oh careless love, can't you see what careless love has done?"
"I'll give 'ee careless love, you virgin bitch," the old woman said. She could smell the sour reek of sweat from under her arms, but that other moisture had dried up again. "I'll give you payday for walking in early on old Rhea, so I will."
She passed her fingers over the lock on the front of the box, but it wouldn't fasten. She supposed she had been over-eager to have it open, and had broken something inside it when she used the touch. The eye and the motto seemed to mock her, "I see who opens me." It could be put right and in a jiffy, but right now even a jiffy was more than she had.
"Pestering cunt," she whined, lifting her head briefly toward the approaching voice, almost here now by the gods, and 45 minutes before her time.
Then she closed the lid of the box. It gave her a pang to do it, because the glass was coming to life again, filling with that rosy glow, but there was no time for looking or dreaming now. Later, perhaps, after the object of Thorin's unseemly late-life prickishness had gone.
"And you must restrain yourself from doing anything too awful to the girl,"
she cautioned herself.
"Remember, she's here because of him, and at least ain't one of those green girls with a bun in the oven and a boyfriend acting reluctant about the cries of marriage. It's Thorin's doing. This one's what he thinks about after his ugly old crow of a wife is asleep and he takes himself in his hand and commences the evening milking. It's Thorin's doing. He has the old law on his side, and he has power. Furthermore, what's in that box is his man's business, and if Jonas found out she looked at it, that she used it—"
"Aye, but no fear of that. And in the meantime, possession were 9/10 of the law, were it not?" She hoisted the box under one arm, hoisted her skirts with her free hand, and ran back along the path to the hut. She could still run when she had to, aye, though few there were who'd believe it. Musty ran at her heels, bounding along with his cloven tail held high and his extra legs flopping up and down in the moonlight.